Jason. I'm an alcoholic.
And really
appreciate you having me. Thanks, Billy. Thanks so much for asking me to come out. Really grateful to be here. I've been to this group before. I assume you guys usually get pretty good speakers. I wouldn't know. The only other time I was here, I spoke. It was awesome. In fact, it was so good that you guys haven't had me out for like 10 years. So you've just been running on that, I guess. My sobriety date is the 21st of December, 1995. My home group is the Midtown group. And I'm an alcoholic, obviously. Otherwise, this would be so awkward. Which basically means that I have an abnormal relationship with alcohol. But that's probably the most important, most relevant piece of information about my alcoholism. Really what I have is I have a spiritual malady, you know, with two primary symptoms, right? And pretty much everyone in this room knows this, but it's part of my talk, so I'll just go through it anyway. The first is that I have this physical reaction to alcohol. That's probably, that's like one of the top two symptoms, right? Is that I love drinking. I love alcohol. When I start drinking, for me, I just keep, you know, there's no like controlling. There's no having one or two. I mean, I've had brief periods in my drinking that were like that. But for the most part, when I pick up a drink, I'm going to get absolutely totally hammered, you know, and not like, buzzed, not like my brother one time, who was a non-alcoholic, but you know, was a young drunk like me, like drinking, was describing what he got from alcohol, and he said, "I just like to get that nice two beer buzz." And I remember looking at him thinking, and I was like, at the time I was like 15. I remember looking at him thinking, like, "Not me, dude. Like, I don't know what you're talking about." So I. This is my physical reaction to alcohol, is that when I take a drink, I want another one and another one until I'm completely hammered. So that's my physical relationship with alcohol. If that's all I had, then I would just stay away from it, and I wouldn't need to come to AA. I wouldn't have any other problems that came along with it. But unfortunately, I also have this second symptom, which is the mental obsession, right? Which basically, when I was drinking, was masked by excitement. You know, I mean, you don't realize that you have a mental obsession until you're trying not to drink, and then it's an obsession. But for most of my drinking, it was more like I thought about going out with my friends and getting hammered, and I loved it. I would get pumped, I would get excited, and I just could not wait. In fact, you know, I'll tell you one of the strongest examples of the mental obsession that I have from when my drinking was still fun was I got an effect produced by having alcohol. Even before I drank, if I had a bottle like with me, you know, like in the back seat of a car going to drink, and I had like my own bottle of bourbon like next to me, that's why I love to drink Evan Williams bourbon. Not because it was what I preferred, but because it was really cheap and I never had any money. But I felt better just having that bottle next to me. And that's because I have this mental relationship with alcohol, this like obsession, and that's because I get so much out of drinking, and that never can be relieved by Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's the deadly part of my illness. If I don't pick up another drink, I never have to worry about the phenomenon of craving. But that mental component, and it can also be subtle. The other thing about the mental obsession is it's not always like it doesn't always come on like a full on constant barrage of thinking about drinking. Sometimes it can just be really subtle. It can just be like this quiet voice convincing me that, you know, my drinking was a long time ago and I've been sober for a long time, and it can talk to me in my own voice. So those are like those are the two primary symptoms. But really what I have is I have a spiritual malady, and that's something that I had long before I ever picked up a drink. And so the reason that that's important for me to understand about my alcoholism is because that's what we treat here. There isn't really anything that can be done about the two primary symptoms of my alcoholism. In other words, when you come to AA, and in fact it talks about it in the book, if you're you know, suffering from the effects of the physical allergy, meaning you need a physical detox. There's really not that much we can do for you. I mean, people can sort of keep an eye on you and make sure you don't go into convulsions, or they can take you to a detox, and we really kind of leave that up to the medical professionals to handle that aspect of it. But there's really nothing in the big book that talks to how to, other than just don't drink. For the mental obsession, there are some measures that we can take in AA. You know, people will tell you, you know, especially when you're new, when I was new, spend as much time as possible hanging out with other people in Alcoholics Anonymous. If there, I don't know if there's a meeting before the meeting, show up, you know, early for that. Go to the meeting after the meeting. If people are going to the, you know, when I got sober, a lot of people went to the diner or played spades, or basically the purpose of, or, you know, there would be dances or other activities in AA, and the purpose of that is basically to keep a newcomer like me busy enough, surrounded by safe influences, so that we can work on the underlying problem, which is the spiritual malady, and just allow someone who's new to tread water long enough for the solution to take hold. But we don't really have a treatment for the mental obsession other than to keep you busy and share our experience, you know, which is, you know, for me, that I've been there and that I completely understand. And sometimes that can bring a little help. We don't treat the two symptoms. We treat the underlying problem, you know. And that's that there's something wrong with my spirit. And I knew that before I ever picked up a drink. I knew that there was something wrong with me. I come from a good home. I got great parents. They got divorced when I was really young. I don't remember them ever being married. There's no scarification that happened there. I just always had a dad who was really active in my life, lived nearby, and my mom and my stepfather. That's sort of like my earliest memories, or my family unit being like that. And I have an older brother and a couple of older stepbrothers and a younger brother and younger sister. So I was right in the middle of a good family. You know, we were signed up for sports and put on teams and went to good school. I mean, just everything. I had every opportunity, you know. And I grew up in a town called Ellicott City, which is a suburb outside of Baltimore. Great town. My brother and my stepbrothers, we were like the bad kids in the neighborhood. You know, we were in a gang. It was the suburbs, so fortunately for me and my safety, there were no rival gangs, but we were definitely in one. And we would just walk around with like homemade weapons looking for trouble, you know. And then when we couldn't find any, we would just find a street sign to vandalize or something like that, you know, or somebody's windows to shoot out with a BB gun. Like, we were that like house in the neighborhood, you know. You know, my parents were great. My dad was great. My mom and my stepfather, wonderful people, but they just had like these hellion kids, you know. And so we were like that house where, like, if like your hood ornament was missing when you came out for work in the morning, in my neighborhood, that was me or someone or my brother, you know. Or if your car stereo, when I'm used to speaking at like kind of young people's meetings, and I'm looking around realizing that I'm not like the old guy in the room, which is no offense to anybody, but it's like pretty, because I don't have to like explain some of, you know, like, you, like in the 80s when I was growing up, like people were really like bad, or kind of the bad kids were into like stealing car stereos. So we got into that kind of thing. And I used to love stealing. I didn't even like stealing to have whatever I was stealing. I loved the effect produced by stealing. I loved to walk into, you know, in my case, the Columbia Mall with like an empty backpack at 10 and leave, and it would be full and I hadn't spent a dime. You know, I just was always attracted to trouble. And a lot of times when somebody starts drinking, you'll see, you know, sort of like signs that you should look for, symptoms that your child may be abusing alcohol or drugs. One symptom to look for, one sign, is that your child's grades might start to drop. This was never an indication for my family, because I was failing out basically from elementary school on, and put into special education classes, even though there's nothing too mentally wrong with me. I, you know, I was like, it's embarrassing, the simple stuff that I was learning in high school, you know, just because I never wanted to do my work. I never wanted to do what I was supposed to do. So it was not a shock when I started drinking. People weren't like, not Jason, he seems so well adjusted and normal, you know. It was more like, well, that makes sense, you know. And obviously, I mean, I probably don't even need to say this, but my brother and my stepbrothers, you know, they were getting into the same stuff and a few years ahead of me. And I was always that, although I was a middle child, I always felt like I was running to catch up with my older brother and stepbrothers and wanted to get into whatever they were into. And so the truth is, we didn't do a lot of drinking together, but I did have that example growing up, always being a troublemaker and in a family of troublemakers. And so I started drinking as early as I could. For me, I was, you know, probably 13 the first handful of times that I drank, and 14 when I really got drunk. And up to this point, you know, obviously I have this restlessness in my spirit. I have, you know, the constant feeling like I don't fit in, like I'm not a part of. I always had a hard time making friends. I was never like the popular, I don't even think I should need to say this at this point in my story, but I was not like a popular kid, you know what I mean? Like, some people's drinking stories, they're like, you know, like, I was a quarterback, and I was varsity, and dating the head cheerleader, but, like, I never felt like I deserved it. Like, that's not my story, you know what I mean? Like, I wasn't invited to that party, you know what I mean? There's no, never played beer pong. I've never played a drinking game. I've never done a beer bong. Keg stand. None of that. I wasn't like that. I drank King Cobra malt liquor underneath the bridge behind All of You Liquors, you know, with Dave Goldstein. And that's how I roll, you know. The first time I ever got drunk, I was drinking under the bridge with Dave, drinking King Cobra, which was 99 cents for a quart. I can't imagine it's more than $1.25 now. The first probably 20 minutes I'm drinking, of course I'm drinking King Cobra, so it's completely disgusting. I'm thinking, this is terrible. Why do people even do this? I don't get it. You know, this tastes like awful, and I'm just like, it's hot, and I'm hanging out with Dave and, you know, we had this friend, Evan, who was like 24 and hung out with like 14 and 15-year-old kids, you know, which is cool because he could buy us alcohol, but also not that cool, you know. Because he was completely insane. And so I'm like not having fun. I'm under a bridge. It's basically a sewer, you know, because there's a stream going by. And then like halfway to three quarters of the way down this court, I just look over at Dave and I'm like, man, this is awesome, you know. And it's just like, and it's like all of a sudden the world became a friendlier place, you know. And the first time that I experienced the effect produced by alcohol, and it was almost like we were at a beach, you know. There was definitely water there, and sand, you know. And a friend of mine says, you know, alcohol just burned that loser right out of you, you know what I mean? And I just love that. Alcohol gave me the satisfaction of a job well done without having to do anything. And I had been looking for that break my whole life, you know. That's what I loved about booze. And if I had continued to have experiences like that, with little or minimal consequences, then I would have never come to Alcoholics Anonymous. The truth is as lame as it was to be hanging out under that bridge with Dave Goldstein and Evan, that was about as good as it got for me. I was a young drunk, so most of my drinking took place, for the most part, when my family went to sleep. You know, my night started when my parents went upstairs and went to bed, and I had what every young alcoholic loves. I had the best thing for a young alcoholic. I had a basement room, you know, which is like, that is license. I'm not sneaking past any doors. That's just license to go out the second they go to sleep. And so that's how my drinking started. I'd sneak out of my window. Once I heard those footsteps go upstairs, I'd give it like 15 minutes, and I'd leave it open a crack, and I'd go out and I'd meet up with Dave or some of my new friends or whoever I could, and we'd, you know, meet up with somebody who had scored a bottle or a couple of bottles. My preference was to have my own pint of Evan Williams. That's what I loved. If I had that, I was going to have a great night. And I would, you know, hang out in the woods in my neighborhood and drink and, you know, listen to Pink Floyd and hang out. And I had a great time. I loved it. I loved, I came to really love bourbon. I loved the sense of camaraderie. I did not feel that sense of separation that I walked around with most of the time. I didn't feel like I was an alien. I didn't feel like I didn't belong. I felt, and it was the opposite. I felt like I belonged exactly where I was. Alcohol gave me the ability to quiet down my mind, and that the voices that I'd always had my whole life telling me that I wasn't good enough, that I wasn't enough, that I was a loser, all of those were accurate, actually, given my performance up to this point in my life. But I didn't have to listen to that. And so I had a great time for a little while. But unfortunately, if alcohol does that for you, eventually it will start doing things to you. And that's what happened to me, you know. Most of the time that I came home, I'd come stumbling home at like 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning after drinking all night. And, usually I would come home when it was like gray out. Remember that? Like, I don't know. I was like an all-night drinker, so most of my drinking, I'd come home from a night of drinking, and it would be like not sunlight, but not dark, sort of that like between, 5:30 and 6:30 a.m., and birds are chirping, and my night is just ending, you know. The rest of the way, and I also kind of love that about drinking, you know, that sneaky element of it. Like, the rest of the world is fast asleep, you know, and that's when my world starts to really open up. And I kind of check and make sure that that window was still open to crack, which most of the time it was. But the longer I drank, you know, sooner or later my parents started catching on, so they'd come down and check on me. And sometimes I'd be walking up to the house hammered drunk, and that window that I had left open the night before would be closed, which meant that I'd have to walk around to the front of my house and sort of knock on the door and ask to be let back in. And most of the time I was. But, you know, probably the last year, my drinking depended on how much money I had stolen the night before or the week before. Sometimes they wouldn't let me in. You know, one time I remember my stepfather opened the door after me, you know, being on a bender, and he just threw a quarter at me. He said, "Go call your dad. You don't live here anymore." And so I'd have to go sleep it off at my dad's house, and he was always there for me to, you know, to pick me up, to clean me up, to take care of me, to give me a place to stay. I have a great father, you know, who I basically completely cut out of my life for my entire drinking. And the reason was because he's such a loving man that he commanded respect. And since I couldn't, since my drinking put me in a position where I couldn't really honor that, the easiest thing for me at the time to do was to just completely shut him out of my life, unless I absolutely needed him. And so there were those times when I would be given a quarter for a payphone and a phone call, and that was, you know, basically that was when I would reach out to him, and I would, you know, stay in his house, I would sleep it off, and I would manipulate my way back to my mom's house, where it was easier to drink and sneak out and get out and cause trouble. And you know, the longer I drank, I started to go to these clubs. It was the 90s. They had raves. I'm not sure if they had them down here in Madison, but in Baltimore, they were pretty big. And so all of a sudden, I'm like involved in this club scene where I'm like not the weirdest guy in the room, not even in the top 10, you know. And I loved it. I would, you know, get someone to pick me up and take me to downtown Baltimore to these terrible parts of the city. And these clubs would open up at 10 o'clock at night, and I would be the first one through the door and the last one to leave. And I, you know, I loved it. I loved the nightlife. I loved the music. It was a lot of fun. I had a good time. But most of the time that I was out, at this point, I'm not sneaking out so much anymore, you know. At this point, I'm, you know, giving my mom the finger and saying, "I'm out of here," you know, "F you," and whatever else I can think of to shock her, to get around her, to go meet up with my friends and party all night. And so I'd go out and I'd get hammered and I'd start to feel guilty around like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know. Once I'm getting that effect that I had come to love and depend upon, I start to think about the way that I'm affecting my family, the fact that I'm basically flunking out of special ed, and that all of my friends are losers just like me, in and out of jail. That's not my story, but all of my friends have that story from that time. And I would start to feel guilty. And so you might find me at a club at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, outside in some, you know, in like the smoking area, like talking to some good-looking woman, just letting her know what a disappointment I am to my father, you know. And that's not, they don't like that, by the way. Usually I got a lot of like, I'm really sorry, that sucks, you know. So that did, needless to say, I wasn't really a ladies man, you know. I remember one time I stumbled into the bathroom of this, my favorite club, Rise, which is on Russell and Bayard in Baltimore, which is like right downtown where Raven Stadium is now. And the bathroom was the only place that had a payphone. This is BC before I got sober in 95, so none of my story involves like cell phones or texting or anything like that. So everything was payphones, and the bathroom was the only place they could put one, because otherwise you couldn't hear anything because the bass was so loud in these places. And so I'd stumble in, and never had any money. But luckily some nice kid had written their parents' calling card on the bathroom wall for anyone to use. And so I don't know if you guys remember calling cards, but they were like 37 digits long for the calling card number. And so like imagine being like hammered, trying to like use a calling card number that's scribbled by someone else who's hammered, and you know, get your phone number in there, you know. It's like, and this is also the time where, do I dial one or do I not dial one? So like 15 minutes later, I finally, you know, call home on somebody else's calling card, and my stepfather picks up, you know, and I just say in the receiver, "I'm fine, don't worry about me," and hang up, you know, and to alleviate my guilt. And you know, and then maybe the lights come on in the club at 5 a.m. and everyone's like totally gross and disgusting, and you didn't see it that way like when it was dark, and everyone's just kind of like stumbling around, and then sooner or later we'd get shuffled to this after hours party that opened up at 6, and we'd be there from 6 to 10 or 11 in the morning, and then we'd go to somebody's house and just keep on partying throughout the rest of the day. And that didn't just happen to me once or twice or a couple of times. I mean, that was the way that I was living. And one time I ran out of money. I was like almost completely sober, not completely sober, but almost completely sober. And I had nothing, and I was hanging out with people that, you know, were still partying. And so I just had to get out of there. And I called my dad. It's like 5:30 in the morning. He had to come pick me up from the middle of Baltimore City. And, just completely disgusted. And so at this point I'm like scaring and worrying and a disappointment to everyone that's close to me in my life. My alcoholism didn't affect one or two people. It affected the people that were the closest to me the most, and then branched out from there. But there wasn't anybody in my life that was better off for having known me. As everybody caught some collateral damage, whether you were just an acquaintance that I ripped off, or whether you were my grandmother that basically my dad said on my 17th birthday, you know, don't send him any money or gift cards because he'll find a way to spend it on booze or drugs. Or whether, you know, or obviously my parents catching the brunt of my alcoholism. And so I reached a point where I was so guilt-ridden and hopeless most of the time that I felt like I couldn't take it anymore. I remember one time I stumbled out of this club at like 5:30 in the morning, and I went to this gas station on Russell Street. And I remember going in there to get like a soda or something for breakfast. I was really conscious of my diet at this point in time, so I was trying to eat right, you know. And this guy comes in, and he's dressed similar to how I'm dressed right now. You know, he had a gray suit on, as I remember it, you know, coat and tie, and a briefcase, and he gets like a newspaper and a cup of coffee, pays for his gas, and leaves. Which actually, this is not uncommon in gas stations. It happens every day. But I remember seeing this guy and thinking, that is never going to be me. you know, I'm never going to have, and not like, I'm not going to be a sucker. Like I was the sucker, and I knew it in this circumstance, you know. I'm never going to get out of this trap of guilt, remorse, mm-hmm. and going back out, and guilt and remorse, and going back out, and disappointing my family, and ripping off my friends, and being a loser. I mean, I was, you know, my plan was to stay in my parents' basement. There was no SATs going on. There was no, you know, none of that. Nobody expected me to go to college or anything. Like, I was nothing normal that any 16, 17-year-old kid would have going on in their life was happening for me. I was just going out and getting hammered as often as possible. And I remember seeing this guy thinking, that's never going to be me, you know. And now he could have been a serial killer for all I know, but this is just like what I imagine. But the truth is today my life kind of looks like that, you know. Like, to the outward appearances, I have a pretty normal life. I have a very, very good life. But that's all due to Alcoholics Anonymous. So finally, I reached a point where I couldn't take it anymore. My dad, there was a situation that came up. My dad got so frustrated with me, and he's like a very mild-mannered, gentle, pretty negative most of the time, but he's a sweet man. And but he got so animated one time, he just grabbed me, you know, by my collar, and he wrestled me to the ground, and he smacked me in the face, and he said, "What are you doing to our family?" Start, you know, and I just, it shook me up to see him like that, knowing that I was the cause, and it was, I deserved a lot worse than a smack in the face. But I went into the house, and I had told my mom I needed to go to a treatment center. You know, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I just knew I had friends that went to treatment, you know. And if they were hanging out with me after treatment, like, our mission was to get them loaded as soon as possible, you know, just to make sure that they weren't brainwashed or anything. But the only thing I knew about sobriety was rehab. So I asked to be put into treatment. I went into this place called Oakview Treatment Center. It's not there anymore. It's a retirement home now. But I went in, and it said on the chalkboard, "Tears are the antifreeze of the soul." I'm still not sure what that was all about, but you can think about that later tonight. I got nothing out of rehab. It was like a bunch of information. It was total, and I'm not, when I tell this part of my story, it can seem like I'm bashing treatment, and I don't want, that's actually not what I'm doing. This is strictly my experience. I have a spiritual malady. So writing about my triggers, sobriety is a trigger. Like writing about triggers or a relapse prevention plan or filling out a workbook or talking about my issues, all of those things are human powers. They have in my case, they have absolutely zero impact on my alcoholism. I don't have anything I can blame my alcoholism on. I come from a great family, good home, no abuse, nothing weird happened. I just am an alcoholic. And for me, alcohol is my problem, sobriety, or alcohol is my solution, sobriety is the problem, right? So during the day when we're in these, like, you know, group therapy and one-on-ones with counselors, and I had been going through stuff like that my whole life. I was in and out of therapy and on and off of different medications, and none of that stuff ever mattered because it was always someone else with some sort of degree that was like sort of talking at me from a position of authority. But I will say that every night somebody came in from either AA or NA and they told their story. And when these people would come in, and they would talk about their experience, strength, and hope, and what happened with them, and how their alcoholism had ruined their lives, my ears perked up. And I listened. And I thought, these people are just like me. But within 3 days, I decided I needed to leave that place. I was hanging out with, you know, my best buddy in rehab. We'd known each other for all of 3 days. And he's like, "The food here sucks, man. We need to break out of here. You know, let's get out of this place." And I'm like, "Yeah, man, this food sucks. We need to leave." And and he, a day or two goes by, and he forgot about that. But I could not forget because I have a mental obsession. Could not forget about that conversation. So I said to him, "Hey, I'm thinking about getting out of here. You know, do you want to you want to leave? And he was like, I can't, man. I got court. And that sealed my fate because I didn't have court. I didn't have court. I was there because I felt bad about my dad smacking me in the face and telling me I was a disappointment. And so I asked to be put into rehab. So there was nothing legally that was keeping me there. So once he said that, my first thought was, I don't have court. And then it was like you could, you know, just like start the timer because it was going to happen. And I started, you know, kind of sneaking around and asking around. And I found this girl that was interested in leaving. You know, she was the best looking woman in that place that was willing to come with me. And so we started collecting money from other kids that were in treatment to go buy them cigarettes at the gas station up the street and come back. Which, by the way, I don't feel like I have to make amends for. If you're falling for that, if you're in rehab and you're giving somebody else your money, sorry. So maybe I have some growing to do in that department. But anyway, so we probably got like 14 or 16 bucks between us, and we took off. And I, you know, of course, I you know, walked down this, you know, the road to a payphone and started calling people. And this was back in the time where you can't just get everybody all the time. Like, I had to call until I found someone. And my friend Christy came and picked us up, and we went and met up with some other people. And long story short, you know how the story ends. You know, I wound up getting hammered. But all the while that I'm leaving treatment, walking down the road with this girl I don't know, calling people on the payphone, getting picked up in the car, my mind is telling me, you know, and there's probably more than a few people in this room that have had this experience. You don't have to do this. What are you doing? You know how this is going to turn out. You've done this before. You know, don't be stupid. You're in rehab for a reason. Think about your parents. Think about, you know, trying to make something of your life. And it's like every mental argument that I had was being thrown at, don't do it, Jason. And I did not want to. But that voice was not in the driver's seat that night. The argument that wound up getting me hammered that night was the one that I had been winning out for a very long time. And you might have heard of it. It's called, I can't cuss in this meeting, can I?
No.
Okay. F it. Right? You get it. Right? Only that night, obviously, my head wasn't saying that. F it. You're probably going to get drunk anyway, eventually. And if I'm going to get drunk anyway, eventually, there is no time like right now. And that voice went out. I wound up meeting up with some buddies and going out and getting loaded. The second I did, that voice that was telling me, F it, just turned right around on me and look at you, you miserable piece of crap. You can't even make it 1 week. You can't even stay sober for 1 week in rehab. And it's like there wasn't even a moment of enjoyment left. It was straight from, you know, fear and in some sense excitement to depression, guilt, shame, remorse, hopelessness. You know, there may have been a second there, but I missed that. So I just started crying, you know, which is not, again, like not helping my situation with this girl. Begging my friends to put me in, to take me back to treatment. Take me back, I need to go back, you know, I'm an alcoholic, I can't believe I did this again. And like nobody wants to hang out with the rehab guy, you know, the remorseful, crying rehab guy. They're like, no problem, dude, we will take you right back, like right now. So they dropped me and her off, which she wasn't happy about. And 6 hours after I left that place, I'm banging on the doors, crying, begging them to let me back in. Let me back in. I want to be sober. And that's the crux of my alcoholism at this point in my life. Every time I'm sober, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, and all I can think about is how am I ever going to make it without taking a drink. And then the second I go back out, I'm remorseful, I'm hopeless. You know, I'm no fun to be around, and all I can think is, why can't I get sober? And they let me back in long enough to call my family and have me picked up. They wound up calling my mom, and predictably she said, well, I know that he lived here when we dropped him off, but we're not picking him up now. So, and I don't blame her for that at all. So they called my dad, and he came and picked me up. And when the people from the treatment center came out, and the counselor said, you know, well, look, your mom's not getting, your dad's coming to pick you up. And I had all these, I freaked out, and I had all these violent images of the ass kicking or the butt kicking that I was about to endure, and just like imagine, like, you know, and I've never been beaten, but if there's ever a time, you know, it's like when you get thrown out of rehab at 17. So I just had this image of what was going to happen, and what happened was way worse than that. My dad just came and he picked me up, and he was like, you know, he just looked at me, and I just saw that look of pity and disgust. And there was no, all of the fear, all of the pleading, all of the when are you going to get it together, those conversations were gone. They were not happening anymore. He was just like, you ready to go? Okay, come on. There was no more guilt tripping, browbeating, lectures to be endured, none of that. I didn't have to worry about any of that stuff. And that was because he had given up, you know. He was just picking me up to take me home because he loved me, give me a warm bed to sleep in, let me sleep it off, and then figure out what we're going to do tomorrow. And the whole way home, I feel worse than I ever felt in my life, and I'm crying, and I'm telling him it's not going to be this way anymore. Things are going to be different this time. And, of course, any family of an alcoholic has heard that 1,000 times, and he had heard, you know, so many times. Okay, sure, whatever. But for some reason, things were different this time. And I, you know, I can't explain that. I can talk about the circumstances which I've done. I can describe how I felt, which is worse than I'd ever felt in my life. I had a sense that night when I got home. I remember looking at my brother's dog, Mickey, who was named after Mickey's. and I just remember like hanging out with this pup, just feeling lonely, and lonely as hell, and just thinking, I can't do this anymore. I cannot continue to live like this. I can't do this for one more day. I got to get back into a rehab or something. I have to figure something out. Something has to change. And I felt that, you know, way down to my bones. I knew it. And it's like having an experience like that, I can't say that, like, having that experience is the reason why I've stayed sober for now over 20 years. Because a lot of stuff has to happen after that. But I promise you, if I had not had that experience that night of hitting bottom before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not be sober. That has to happen. There's an insistence. You know, there's no must in AA, right? But for long-term sobriety, there's an insistence that an alcoholic must hit bottom. That had to happen for me. I was working with this alcoholic for a little while, a bunch of years ago, maybe 10, 12 years ago. And after a period of time, he returned to drinking. And then 5 or 6 years later, as often happens, he came back to AA. And I saw him and got his number. And, oh, I remember you. And we remembered each other because I had picked him up for a handful of meetings. And I picked him up for a meeting the next day. And I'm like, so how you been? And he's like, awesome. I'm like, really? He has a few days sober. Really? He's like, yeah, man, I just got, this is the World Cup was happening, not this last one, the one before that shit. I guess it's been like 8 years, so 7 years. So he's like, I just got back from Europe, and I was doing this tour all over Europe. Whenever there was a team that was in a game, I'd be in that country, and they had these huge festivals where people were just like outdoors, drinking, watching, you know, the World Cup, and I like met a million people and blah, blah, and he's telling me, and I'm like, there's no way this guy's going to get sober. And, of course, he didn't stay. But I'm thinking, like, why would you ever come to AA if those are the circumstances of your life? You know what I mean? Like, I started out with Dave Goldstein and Evan, and it got so much worse from there. You know? There is no way that I'm going to give Alcoholics Anonymous an honest effort if I don't hit bottom. And luckily for me, I did. And so I, just like as is probably most of the people in this room's story, I came to AA. I was in really bad shape. I had absolutely nothing going for me. And I got involved in a home group, and I got a sponsor. And my sponsor, actually my first sponsor, did not really take me for the steps. I had him for about 90 days. And you know what? he's a good AA member and a good person, and he's still sober, and we're still friends. But what he taught me was about going to the diner, and he taught me about playing spades with people after the meeting, and he got me involved in the fellowship in that way, and going to campouts and stuff. And on one of these campouts, around 2.5 to 3 months over, I met the guy that was to take me through the steps in my first year, and a guy named Lee, and he was, you know, he was an old timer, you know, Lee, and he kind of looked like Jesus. He had long hair and a big beard, and you know, was kind of a hippie, and he'd been sober forever, you know, he had 5 years, and hey man, when you have 90 days, 5 years is an old timer. And Lee had gotten sober, I was 17 when I came to AA, and Lee had gotten sober around 16 or 17, maybe 18, but it was around the same time. And so we started meeting and going through the steps, and when we got to the second step, he said, "So do you believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity?" And I was honest. It sounds like almost like a joke when I say this. I'm just going to preface this. It's not a joke. I was honest. I was like, "Not really, man." And he was like, "Well, to the best of your ability, are you willing to believe?" And I said, "I don't think so." And I was not being rebellious or snarky. I mean, I like about half of the people that come to AA had really thought that I had left the whole God and religion, and you know, and of course I put those two things together 100% of the time, a long time before I even started drinking. I mean, I stopped believing in the stuff that I read in the Bible around the same time I stopped believing in Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny, you know. And I was raised in a good religion. You know, I was raised Catholic. Some people talk about like fire and brimstone, and you're going to go to hell, and if you think it, you may as well have did it. I that's not my memory. I remember being taught that God loves me, and good stories, and fellowship, and going to church, and being generally bored, but full of good people. You know, and my mom raised me Catholic, and I'd spend weekends with my dad, and, you know, my mom taught me about God, and my dad taught me everything your mom's telling you is bull. You know, like, it's like, he was an atheist, you know, and no faulting him for it. He was being honest with me. He was trying to be a good parent. And that's his experience. You know, he said, "Religion's basically, here's the deal, son." And I'm like, nine. He's like, "Nobody wants to die. So people just sort of like make up this like magical land that you float off to after you die. But really, like, you just get eaten by maggots like everybody else." And, and it's like, okay, you know, like, sounds good. Thanks, Dad. Can I go back to watching cartoons now? And again, like, I mean, I've praised him. You know, he's the sweetest man in the world. But that's just like, that's how it was growing up in my family. So I just didn't have much for him. And Lee, he did the best that he could for me. And it was the best possible thing that he could have done. He pointed me to the chapter We Agnostics in the spiritual appendix in the back of the book. And reading that chapter had a profound impact on me. And it wasn't like, I didn't have like a spiritual experience like, okay, I was wrong, there is a God. It wasn't like that. It was, a few things happened. One, I recognized immediately from reading that chapter in the big book, this program is designed for someone exactly like me. Like, not only am I relating to stories that I hear in AA and sort of get the sense that I understand you and you understand me, and people are sharing about things that I hadn't even up to that point been able to put words to, but that I understand sort of in that language of the heart way that I identify, and I belong here. I need to be here. But this guy in this chapter that was written in the 30s, the late 30s, wrote something that completely keys into all of my arguments for why there's no way that there's a higher power out there. And so so I went from no to maybe, you know, and the spiritual appendix helped with that too. And that's, that might not be like a white light experience, but that was enough to make my beginning and to move on with the rest of the steps. I didn't get a lot about step three. I didn't really understand it, but we moved on. And, And I started praying every night and thanking God for my sobriety. And every morning I would say a prayer asking for help. And my prayers, it's mostly that simple today. I don't complicate it too much more than that. In the evening, a lot of times, usually my prayer routine is I'll pray for people that are close to me or that I know are struggling or going through difficulties. In the morning, I ask God for, you know, to help me stay sober and to help me to do His will. And I don't like go throughout my day and like think, what's God's will? What's my will? What, you know, am I on the right path? I don't have any of those intellectual conversations. I just sort of live my life and go about my business and do the best I can and stay on track by hopefully staying really involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's been working pretty good so far. I got with my sponsor and he had me write out an inventory. I totally screwed it up. I probably had like 4 or 5 months when I wrote my 4-step. If you were to look at like a textbook example of a 4-step, which actually there is a textbook example right here, you know, and I had that to follow, but totally blew it. You know what I mean? I would have failed for sure. But the reality is that in a lot of senses in AA, you're really graded on your effort, you know, and we set the bar really low. And so the point is regarding my 4-step, I did the best that I could and I put my blood and guts on the page. I put everything on there. And everything that I was ashamed of, everything that I was never going to tell anybody, and I, you know, included my resentments and all, you know, and everything else was in there. But it wasn't like my I's were not dotted, the T's were not crossed. But it was definitely good enough. And I sat down with this man and I talked to him about stuff that I had never told anybody. And even though I got sober really young, I was 17, at this point in my life, I already had a ton of stuff that I'm never going to tell anybody about this, you know. I'm going to die with this one. And some of it wasn't even like stuff that I had did, but just things that I had thought, ideas that I had. And when you live your life as a liar, like I did, and don't bounce the truth off of anybody ever, not even your parents or therapists or counselors or anyone, then a lot of those ideas that bounce around for 3, 4, 5, or 6 years, they wind up coming out pretty screwed up. And this guy, man, in one simple conversation was able to set me straight on a ton of stuff that I had been way, way wrong about. And it wasn't like an intellectual, like, oh, I used to think about things in this way and now I'll just look at them that way. It was more like the relief of having shared a confidence with another man and not being rejected. In fact, a lot of the stuff that I was the most worried about and ashamed of was this guy's exact experience. And I don't know how that seems to work out, but it just works out that way a lot of times in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the 6 and 7 steps, we sort of talked about briefly, and then I ignored them for 10 years until they ruined my life, and then slowly came back to it. I'm not really kidding about that part, by the way. I sort of skipped over 6 and 7. I didn't really have much of an understanding. And we sat down, and he had me write a list of people that I had harmed. It was pretty simple, basically anybody that I'd ever met, you know, made the list. And the way that it was explained to me, it's okay to write too much, you just don't want to write too little. And so we got together and we went through that list and determined which ones probably didn't need to be made, which ones probably shouldn't be made, you know, what's financial, what's not. And we went through all that and how I was to make amends. And I, to the best of my ability, I started cleaning up the wreckage of my past. Within my first year, the big stuff had pretty much been taken care of in terms of 8 and 9. And that's not to say that the relationships were whole, but they were definitely with my mom, with my dad, with my stepfather, with my younger siblings, with my older brother. Those relationships it's indescribable how different they were, you know. And a lot of that had to do with my attitude. Remember, when I came to AA, even from my first day, first week, first couple of weeks, I wanted to start setting things right. And it's not like I ran out and made amends right away, but I got sober primarily because of the guilt and the shame I felt for the way that I was treating the people in my life that loved and cared about me and that I loved and cared about. And so once the obsession was lifted, which for me was pretty much immediate after hitting bottom, when I say this, I'm not trying to say this like in a prideful way, because it wasn't like that. But I immediately wanted to make those relationships right. And I really did everything that I could to work towards that. From even my really early sobriety. I remember for my dad's birthday, which is in January, and just really shortly after I had gotten sober, I didn't have any money. I never had money. He gave me $10 a week. Every penny of it went to cigarettes. I was not putting a dollar in the basket or paying for my food at the diner. So I had, you know, when his birthday rolled around, I had basically nothing, you know. And I remember just sitting down with a pen and a piece of paper, not even a card, and just writing him a letter, which ultimately ended up being an amends letter. These are the things that I've done in a general way, and I know that they've caused you pain. And I know what kind of son I've been, and I hate it. And now, I'm in AA for a short period of time, but I really feel like it's going somewhere, and this is what I want to do in the future. This is what I want our relationship to look like. And he saw me, he came and read this letter I left for him, you know. I didn't even, like, hand it to him. Like, we're living in the same house. I'm just, like, leaving it out, going downstairs. You know what I mean? Like, and he, you know, he's in the kitchen. We're in the kitchen. He, you know, he just says, so I read your letter. And I was like, yeah. And he was like, I loved it. I loved that letter you gave me. And he, you know, reached out and gave me a big hug. And it's like, it's incredible what Alcoholics Anonymous can do. You know, what we can do in terms of putting our relationships with our families back together. You know, and today, My life doesn't look anything like it did when I got to wrap up. When I was new in sobriety, when I was first going through the steps, when I was 17, 18 years old, it's completely different, you know. But every good thing in my life is as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I try to go to meetings. I still go to a ton of meetings. I go to meetings almost every day, probably 5-6 a week. I sponsor a handful of guys in AA. I do the best I can to be there for them, to take them through the steps. I still have a sponsor that I call. And my rule is the last thing I want to tell my sponsor, that's the first thing I tell my sponsor. You know, if I stick to that rule, then I have a clear conscience and an open relationship with him. And I got a good life. I got a little dog, a little white dog who weighs like 12 pounds, you know. And a little car and a good job and a beautiful wife and baby on the way now, you know. It's like I have all this love in my life, you know. And it is so different than the person that I was when I was out there drinking. And it's only AA that I have to thank for that. So thanks a lot for the opportunity to tell my story, and thanks for letting me share.